This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Nan Robertson loved the newspaper she wrote for 33 years, the New York Times. But that didn't stop her from suing the paper in 1974. Robertson was part of a group of female employees that charged the Times with systematic sex discrimination. The lawsuit was settled out of court in 1978. Nan Robertson has now chronicled the New York Times' rocky history with women in a new book called The Girls in the Balcony. Robertson retired from the paper in 1988. She went on to write a book about her experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous called Getting Better. She told me about the balcony she refers to in the title of her new book.
The balcony at the National Press Club is a balcony that I stood in not so many years ago. It is where women reporters had to stand to hear world leaders speak at the National Press Club. It was decided in 1955 that they would let women reporters step over the threshold of the all-male National Press Club to cover events. And so what they did was they put us up in the balcony until 1971. And we were jammed up in that balcony listening to, assigned to listen to these world leaders and to cover these events. We stood up in the balcony packed together while the men down on the ballroom floor, the members of the National Press Club, scarfed up a four-course meal. It was usually during luncheon. And not only could we not hear the speaker well, we got no lunch. We were standing instead of sitting, and we were not allowed to ask questions. We were shown out at the end through a back door. We sort of skulked out through a back door, and this was true until 20 years ago when the National Press Club, after years of internal fighting, finally admitted women as members.
Now, were you literally then staring down on the male reporters who were, as you say, scarfing down a very nice meal with obviously the speaker right in front of them?
Yes, it was at the other end of the ballroom. The podium was at the opposite end from the balcony. And it was worse than the back of the bus because the back of the bus, as one of my friends and colleagues points out in the book, gets everybody to the same destination just as well. We could not really cover well because we couldn't hear well. And so we started a little mutiny at the New York Times Bureau and told Scotty Reston, the great and idolized journalist who was our bureau chief, there were three women then in the bureau, that we will no longer cover events at the National Press Club until they brought us down from the balcony. And Reston was not pleased.
Did this balcony become a symbol of sexism in other news organizations as well, for other women who were there to cover speakers?
Of course it did. I mean, we all remember it. Everybody of our generation, I mean, great reporters and writers like Mary McGrory stood up there. And, you know, Pulitzer Prize winners, although there weren't many women Pulitzer Prize winners at the time. But it was humiliating. I mean, we were fuming up there, and we were hungry up there, and we were hot up there with the television crews up there with their hot lights. It was the worst, the ugliest symbol of discrimination in journalism that I know of.
Was the Times slow to hire female reporters?
Very. It was one of the most backward major papers in the nation to do so. The Times has always moved glacially, always moved slowly in terms of women. Its sort of male tone was set by the patriarch of the family that still owns it, Adolph Ochs, who bought the New York Times in 1896. And for 40 years, while he was publisher, only four women got on the news staff, and they sort of sneaked in by mistake. He fought women's suffrage in his editorial columns, and personally, he believed women belonged at home. Meantime, his daughter Iphigenie, the great matriarch of the family, who really is figures in the background of this book, was sneaking her pocket money, all of it, to the Women's Suffrage Committee at Barnard College.
You began working at the Times in 1955. Can you describe for us then what it was like to work in this kind of environment where women working there then were considered somehow second-class employees?
When I came to the Times in 1955, I had 7 years behind me as a foreign correspondent doing general reporting for other newspapers. I was immediately sent to the women's page to cover fashion because once I had been a publicist for Dior and spent 5 years trying to get to the City Room, which is where you really learn the nuts and bolts of the trade because you cover everything. I finally got there. When I arrived at the Times, I mean, all of us women have described it this way. The City Room of the Times, a vast block-long room, was a sea of men. And there was a little handful of women, I think five at the time, who were all put in these. There was row after row of men. And then in the middle were the five women seated together, this island of women in a sea of men, as everybody described it.
When did you begin to sense that there were real salary disparities between what male reporters and female reporters were paid at the New York Times? People are often very private about their salaries, and it's sometimes very difficult information to get from people.
Well, we didn't get it from people in that way. You're quite right about people not wanting to discuss their salaries. What we did was, and I say we because I was a founding member of the Women's Caucus at the New York Times, what we did in the early 70s was to go to the payroll. We had access to that. We had the right to access. And the Newspaper Guild gave us the printouts of the payroll so that we could expunge the names but discover patterns of inequality. And that's when everybody really got mad. We found out that there was this disparity in wages between men and women doing the same jobs across the board.
How big was the disparity?
It was then about $3,000 a year, and it kept growing, even though the Times was hiring more and more women reporters because their bylines were visible. The readers could see that more women were working for the Times. So more were hired by the City Room, but the disparity began at $59 a week and widened, that's about $3,000 a year, widened till it was $7,000 a year in 1977, the year before the suit was settled, on the day it was supposed to go to trial. So you have this, and that nothing makes people madder than to learn that they are paid less money for doing the same work.
Is that why you formed the Women's Caucus, to begin to address some of these issues?
We formed it partly because that was the climate of the Times. Newsweek's women had already brought a suit in 1970. It was the modern women's movement emerged around 1970, and women were holding consciousness-raising groups all over the country. We became aware that there were inequities. I mean, my generation didn't get mad until we discovered how unequally we were being treated. I mean, we loved it when people said, "You think like a man," or "You write like a man." We thought that was a compliment. And so we had a certain, women of my generation had a kind of retroactive anger about the fact that we were patronized, that we were paid less, that we never got to be boss unless it was boss of the women's page. And it was a very salutary anger because it brought us to action.
When you brought this disparity to the attention of people at the New York Times, what was their reaction? Did they take you seriously?
Well, the first meeting with the management of the Times was in the very imposing boardroom on the 14th floor. The men sat on one side, the women sat on the other. Eileen Shanahan, a very great reporter, and I flew up from Washington to be there. And in retrospect, their attitude of astonishment and surprise reminded me of the senators during the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings. Why, you mean that women really are paid less than men? I mean, that women can't cover sports, that nobody's in the pipeline to power, that they can't cover business and economics? Why, this is amazing. It was like the senators at the hearing, the Hill-Thomas hearings, being astonished that sexual harassment takes place in the workplace. And so their attitude was, why, we have to do something to correct this inequity, the series of inequities. inequities. We'll form committees. We'll have meetings. We'll do something about this. Punch Sulzberger is a genial, decent man. He was then publisher, and the men around him, one of them argued that he had, the Sunday editor, Dan Schwartz, argued at this meeting that, he said, why? He said, I'm bringing women along. I have a list here of the women I've made editors in the last few years. And the woman opposite him said, Dan, she said, the last time you made a woman in the Sunday department and an editor was 10 years ago, and I was that woman.
So did they think?
So everybody burst out laughing, and he was absolutely, nonplussed. I mean, he was really taken aback.
Well, let me quote the attorney that you hired to file the class action suit, and this is Harriet Schaffer Robb, and she said, talking about the Women's Caucus, they were so womanly, so accommodating. They believed that if you sat down and talked with management, everything would be okay.
That's exactly the way we felt at the beginning. And there ensued a series of dozens of meetings, and a very wonderful guy who was the specialist in labor relations, John Mortimer, went around to all of the managers below Punch Sulzberger, the publisher, and he would say, now we have to change this. We have to do something about this. We've got to bring more women in. We have to pay them equally. And the managers would say, sure, sure, we'll act on this. And nothing happened, mostly because Punch did not lean on them and say, it's not enough to put out a quality paper. We have to treat the employees equally.
Nan Robertson is my guest, and from 1955 to 1988, she worked at the New York Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her story about her own near-fatal attack of toxic shock syndrome, and she's just written a book about a suit against the New York Times, a suit against the sex discrimination that many of the female employees discovered there, and the book is called The Girls in the Balcony. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with journalist Nan Robertson, who's just written a book called The Girls in the Balcony, Women, Men, and the New York Times. What then made you want to file the class action suit, and what specifically then did you ask for in the suit?
We asked that that the disparity in salaries, which was ever growing during the negotiations that preceded the suit, that disparity be wiped out. We asked that there be a specific number of women in management, in various jobs that had been held only by men before. This was agreed to by the Times. It was settled on October 6, 1978, with all these promises from the Times. And very little follow through, even under court decree. Again, it was a lot of talking and very little action. The interesting thing is that there has been more action to close the gap in salaries and to put the women into positions of responsibility in recent years. For instance, in the 10 years after reunion in 1988 of the Women of the Times, we just sort of talked about the gains and the losses, certainly in terms of women covering things. Women are covering sports. The national editor is a woman. The arts and leisure, the cultural Sunday section is the editor of that is a woman. You have a woman covering the Supreme Court. You have, for the first time, a co-chief White House correspondent, Maureen Dowd. In my generation, the women covered the White House family. That's it. I mean, they didn't cover the president unless the male correspondent was ill or out of town. So in every field of coverage, women now are making a change. I mean, look at the front page of the New York Times any day during this political year, and you will find female names. I mean, there were several of them up in New Hampshire doing front page stories about the New Hampshire primary.
And yet you seem to be saying that during these 4 years where the suit was going on and even the years that followed, mm-hmm. there wasn't much change at the New York Times.
There was not significant change. The country was changing and women were getting more and more opportunities, but it really isn't enough. However, the new publisher of the Times, young Arthur Sulzberger, Punch's son and heir, who just became publisher in January, has been has been fighting, did fight as deputy editor and I hope deputy publisher and I hope will as publisher to close the gap in salaries. Let me give you an example. In about 1987, the gap between across the board between men and women at the New York Times in the editorial side was $13,000. On the business side, it was $25,000. This is across the board. Young Arthur Sulzberger has, as his father has not, leaned on his managers and said that the Times must reflect the society and has closed the gap on new hires in the editorial, on the editorial side of the Times, and has brought it down to about $7,000 on the business side. He is an avowed feminist. He is performing as one. And I see a lot of hope for the Times in the future.
You mentioned the fact that you were able to get to the payroll and get to see the disparities again between male and female employees at the Times.
Yes.
Were you also able to get to personnel files? Because that often contains information that can be very revealing in a different kind of way.
Of course we did. During the litigation, the lawyer got discovery rights. And so she was able to go into many hundreds of private memos. We got into the personnel records, personal correspondence involving the Times and so on. And some of those were extremely revealing and very disheartening.
In what way?
You would have the personnel manager telling a secretary that he didn't think she would get very far because her looks were not very great. You have the Sunday editor suggesting in jest but very tastelessly that a candidate for a job, a woman candidate, perhaps she could be send in her picture in a bikini. You have men saying, heads of departments saying, this woman is terrific. I'd make her my assistant if she were not a woman. I mean, it's all there. It was right there. And all the time, the salary gaps were widening. It was infuriating.
Were these then private conversations about female employees, or were these the kinds of things that men working at the Times felt they could say to the female employees?
Well, there were what one of the men called tits and ass cracks that were made and overheard by women employees, you know, conversations between men. And these were passed along as sort of oral history lore. I want to point out here that the women who sued the Times loved the Times. They really wanted to make it a better place to work. They know the respect in which the Times quite deservedly is held. They simply wanted to make it live up to its public stance. I mean, but all the time that we were litigating and negotiating with the management, and there were editorials in the Times saying this has got to reflect our corporations must reflect a diverse society. The lawyers were fighting the suits by the minorities and the women tooth and nail behind the scenes.
How much resentment would you say the suit created at the New York Times? And it was settled out of court.
Yes, in our favor.
In your favor.
I might add. Although the Times said we are totally vindicated and we have this wonderful affirmative action program. And as I described it, their press release that they issued the day that we won was, this has been a total vindication for the New York Times and our wonderful affirmative action program. And we will go on to do better things. And I said it all was sort of summed up in a statement I thought up, which was, we didn't do it and we won't ever do it. Again.
Well, why did the suit, though, bring no change?
But it did bring change. It brought all the changes that you see on the business side and on the editorial side, on women having many more opportunities. But getting up to now, to a certain level, I mean, that glass ceiling, but there are many more women in positions of power at the Times, not very high power. There are only three women on a masthead of 16 16 or 17 men, but that's more than there, you know, that there were 20 years ago or even 12 years ago. There have been changes at the Times, as there have been in the country. It's just, I feel, it's not far enough for half the population.
And those attitudes that you found in those personnel files, do you think those have changed as well? The ones
they,
that...
They have changed among the younger men, and that includes the new publisher. For instance, I broke open the last chapter of the book so that I could recount the episode last year of the unprecedented Times staffers protest meeting, which was called for them to face down management about the sleazebag coverage of the rape accuser in the Palm Beach William Kennedy Smith case. They thought, the staff thought, that the Times had really lowered its journalistic standards and was treating the woman before the trial like a slut.
Well, just to refresh our listeners, not only did the Times name this woman, which most of the newspapers around the country did not, mm-hmm. but went into her personal life in a very nasty kind of way.
They treated her like a slut. They treated her like a supermarket tabloid. And I wanted to make very plain that this meeting, which was called and which is unprecedented at the Times, there were 300 people packed into the WQXR auditorium within the building, that this incident demonstrates how much the attitudes have changed among the staff of the Times. For instance, almost half the people there in the audience were men. Many of them were younger men. Many of the younger men asked tough questions of the management. And Max Frankel appeared to sort of slide sideways. He sort of eluded the questioning. And Alan Siegel, whom I must praise, the assistant managing editor, admitted that he was stunned by the reaction, that it had changed his attitude, that for the first time in his life, he realized the grief and the outrage that women feel about rape, that it is an act of violence, that it's not a sexual act, that he read the story too hastily, that he had something pressing that was personal and left the building too soon. Alan stood four square, you know. Max didn't. I must say, in all fairness, that Soma Golden, the national editor, a woman, did not get it any better than Max. But by God, the women in that audience and the young men certainly got it.
Nan Robertson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Marty.
Nan Robertson wrote for the New York Times from 1955 until 1988. Her book is called The Girls in the Balcony. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.